Welcome, everybody. I'm Wendy Cramp, and this class is Bravery 101, Lessons from Daring Greatly. Thank you for joining me. I consider you to be my fellow fear fighters. We're going to be talking about Brené Brown's book, Daring Greatly, and how the courage to be vulnerable transforms the way we live, love, parent, and lead. And I'll just make one housekeeping note. I'd love to keep the line open and unmuted if possible, just because it's great to hear your voices. So if you have background noise where you are, if you could please mute yourself, you can hit *6, or better yet, use the mute button on your phone. And my intentions for this class are to help you understand what it means to dare greatly and to better understand vulnerability and courage, and to share strategies for dealing with the discomfort that comes with vulnerability. So this content is not always easy, but I'd like this class to feel easy. So I invite you to relax and trust that you will remember what you need to remember from this class. If you haven't heard of Brené Brown, she's a shame and vulnerability researcher, and her book, Daring Greatly, is about the relationship between vulnerability and courage. Her TEDx talk has been viewed so far over 20 million times, so she certainly hit a nerve with a lot of us. If you haven't read Daring Greatly, hopefully a summary of the lessons will inspire you to think about vulnerability differently. And if you have read it, the book, this class may be a reminder of what you already know. And if you have read it, you know it's a meaty book. So this class will be an overview of the research. And we'll stop a couple of times just to hear any reflections that you might have. I'll be asking for your input because it helps us all to learn. But I won't be calling on anyone. I will invite you to be brave and share your reflections and ask questions. If you don't feel like talking, that's absolutely cool. I'm just glad you're here. And I've planned about 35 or 40 minutes to talk through the highlights of Daring Greatly. And I'd like to leave 10 minutes for questions and discussion, and then we'll wrap up the call. So first, I'd like to take a moment to think about what bravery looks like. So I'm going to ask you, this group, to share one or two sentences about what you think is brave. It can be someone you know or someone you don't know. It can be an act of bravery that is big or small. The small stuff certainly adds up. I'll give you a few seconds to think about an example of bravery. And I'll also share a couple of examples to get us started. I think people who get on the scale every day are brave. this past weekend, there was an event here in Coronado called Healing for Warriors. And I think it's brave when soldiers with PTSD try yoga for the first time because they've heard it might help. So I'd love to hear other acts of bravery, just a sentence or two. Who would like to go next?
This is Candy. I think that the first thing that popped into my mind is being different and, you know, just kind of getting away from what you've always been told is right and following your own path. I think that's very brave.
So do I. Thank you.
Wendy, this is Kim Hibbard, and I will follow that up by saying the first thing I thought of was Caitlyn Jenner.
Yes. We've had a lot of examples of bravery in the press recently.
Yeah, that's very brave at her age.
Yeah, it feels like a lightning bolt moment almost, right? Like we're all aware of that example, and we're all connecting to that bravery. At least that's how it feels to me. So thank you. Anybody else think any examples of bravery come to mind?
Hi, Wendy. It's Michelle.
Michelle.
And Candy, hi, it's so nice to hear your voice.
Hi, Michelle.
I think bravery, when you say you don't know something, like in a meeting at work, I just did that recently, and I was like, oh, my God, I feel horrible afterwards. But I just, like, I was like, I don't know, and I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't get that done, and I don't know why. I just didn't, so I'll do it. So patting myself on the back here. It was brave.
Like telling the truth. Being honest.
Oh, sure, you could call it that. All right, I'll mute myself again. Otherwise, I won't stop talking. So.
And Tracy's here too, Rasheed, just so you know. She's just on mute.
Tracy!
Sorry. Hi,
I'm sorry to everyone else on the call, but they're my people.
Tracy, I have one.
Oh, please.
Somebody, a young person in my life, a 15-year-old girl, and she is setting boundaries with a parent that are very necessary. And she's tremendously brave to be doing that so young. So.
And because you cut out just a little bit, Tracy, you said setting boundaries with a parent. Is that right?
Yeah, with a parent who's narcissistic, really.
Okay, narcissistic.
So, yeah. And abusive. Like, just she's doing a great job doing things that are very brave for anybody, but especially a 15-year-old. So she's kind of my hero right now.
No joke.
All right, I'm muting again because I have a baby coughing in the back. But he's okay. Don't worry.
Okay. I know you're a good parent. anyone else want to add to that list of brave people or things? Okay, that's all right. I like the examples. Really nice. Thank you. I chose to teach this class Bravery 101 because I want to continue to boost my own courage. I'm currently in a master coach training program, and I have been given assignments designed to push my edges, both personally and professionally. And during this training, I've thought a lot about bravery and daring greatly, and I see my coaching clients wrestle with it too. So I'm offering this class because I want to keep engaging with the material in Brené's book. And even though this book came out in 2012, I still need it. And I know that practice makes permanent. And I want to be the leader of my life and have new experiences and meaningful relationships. And I know that each of those things requires vulnerability. So we'll start with the basics, which is vulnerability is defined as risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure. And I hope that this class will inspire you to embrace these discomforts in order to become braver. Does anybody have a question or comment before we dive into the Daring Greatly lessons? Okay. So Brené starts by talking about human connection. She says that's why we're all here, and I would agree with that. We are hardwired to connect with others. It's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. And if we don't have this connection, we suffer. And yet many of us are feeling fear, the fear that we're not worthy of real connection, that we're not worthy of love and belonging. And I'm sure we've all been aware of these thoughts of not good enough, not perfect, thin, powerful, successful, smart, or certain enough. And there's also the added fear of being ordinary and the fear of having a small life. So these, you know, universal fears and the feeling of not being enough have created a culture where we're focused on scarcity or lack. And Brené shared a quote from the book, The Soul of Money by Lynn Twist, which paints a vivid picture of this culture, and this has really stayed with me, so I'm going to read this a little bit to you. For me and for many of us, our first waking thought of the day is, I didn't get enough sleep. The next one is, I don't have enough time. Whether true or not, the thought of not enough occurs to us automatically before we even think to question or examine it. We spend most of the hours and the days of our lives hearing, explaining, complaining, or worrying about what we don't have enough of. Before we even sit up in bed, before our feet touch the floor, we're already inadequate, already behind, already losing. Already lacking something. And by the time we go to bed at night, our minds are racing with a litany of what we didn't get or didn't get done that day. We go to sleep burdened by those thoughts and wake up to that reverie of lack, end quote. So I can certainly relate to that description. I often feel like there's never enough time. And I'd like to hear from you guys, where do you notice scarcity or lack in your lives? Is sleep, money, time, love?
Yes, all of the above.
Yes, all of the above. Would you add anything to that list?
Sunshine in Seattle, although right now we're good, but yeah.
Nice. You have a heat wave, I know. I've been watching you.
No, but all kidding aside, Wendy, that I loved when you just read that, I was like, wow, when you put it that way, we seem so dumb. But I will say I often wake up with that same, you know, like that feeling of, oh, I didn't get enough sleep and I've got to, you know, I've got to do better tomorrow night. And but I read this thing, or I think it was either on NPR or Reddit, where it said if you tell yourself you got a good night's sleep, you can actually convince yourself of it and you get calmer. So very interesting.
Nice. That extra lesson, everybody.
Fake it till you make it, baby.
Yeah. As long as it feels true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that I just finished reading The Soul of Money, coincidentally.
Oh.
And you know, when I read that part of the book, well, the whole book is just like, it just kind of brings to light so much of the automatic thinking that we do around everything, money and time and and I think that it, you know, just like Daring Greatly, at first I just totally hated that book because it just like everything was in my face. And I think The Soul of Money was the same thing as far as all of these just automatic thoughts about, you know, not having enough and, you know, building a coaching practice. It's just like, you know, I have given my notice, I'm quitting work the end of August, and it's just like, holy fuck. So I'm just kind of like, yeah, that scarcity thing, it just kind of automatically happens, and before I know it, you know, I'm off on a whole, like, you know, depression thing or whatever it is, freak out, and then I have to just say, oh, yeah. And, you know, it's really, I think it takes a lot of work to kind of try to reverse that because it just automatically happens.
Yeah, that freak out of, you know, those repetitive thoughts, which are already so powerful, and then you add anxiety on top of it, and it just seems to really tighten its grip. And I don't know if this is true, but this client who read an article on brain science, you know, this new revelation, they've been able to track the brain live instead of delayed reporting, and they're now learning that to counteract a thought or a negative experience requires 144 replacements of, you know, so, you know, where we might have thought, oh, you know, challenge that thought or think something differently, it might require more effort for some of those really sticky ones or the really paralyzing ones, more effort to not slide back into that habit. And I don't know if 144 is the magic number, but it just shows how powerful the habit can be and that how often we might not even be aware that we're doing that, that we're going to bed primed to think about how late it is, or I do the math on how little sleep I'm going to get. You know, I think if I fall asleep right now, I'll get 7 hours or whatever. So it's like, I do that automatically. I'm not even aware of it sometimes.
Hey, Wendy, this is Kim.
Hey, Kim.
I wanted to share with you guys, I own a business, and right by our computer, we have one of Louise Hay's affirmations that said, the ocean, what is it, Tam? The ocean of life is lavish with abundance. Money comes easily to me. So affirmations like that are awesome to have in front of you all the time when you're dealing with that fear, you know. So we find that we just love to look at that every day, and it just changes your energy. So that's my contribution to that fear.
Thank you, and especially if the brain science of this new report is true and you need 144 impressions, having it by your phone or somewhere where you would easily see it, if it resonates with you, you know, even if you're not actively thinking that, that image and that impression is being made on your brain. And even if it, you know, it might give you a little peace in that moment, but it's even doing something even more beneficial, which is rewiring your perspective. So thank
right.
you, Kim.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's just it's that constant reminder that we need, which, you know, that's just the way it is.
Well, when you said it, I actually relaxed a little bit.
Yeah.
So this all this scarcity mentality and this feeling of not enough, whether, you know, about ourselves personally, but also about time and sort of external things, sleep and money and sunshine, has, Brené feels, has created a culture where everyone is hyper aware of lack. And, you know, from an energetic perspective, we get scarcity because we live it. And her solution for this scarcity culture is to create a life that's defined by courage, compassion, and connection. And her research indicates that vulnerability is the catalyst. I'm saying this really slow. Vulnerability is the catalyst for courage, compassion, and connection. So again, vulnerability is uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. It's being all in. Can be extremely uncomfortable, and we can spend a lot of energy trying to outrun and outsmart vulnerability. I think I'm a pro. And to better understand vulnerability, we're going to look at some of the myths about vulnerability, and Brené discusses four of them. The first one is the myth that vulnerability is weakness. And according to Brené, this is the most widely accepted and most dangerous myth. If we spend most of our lives avoiding vulnerability, then we don't like it when other people don't stuff their feelings, suck it up, and soldier on like we are. And we've come to the point where rather than respecting the courage and daring behind vulnerability, we tend to judge and criticize it. And in reality, this vulnerability is the core of all of our emotions. So there is vulnerability in fear, shame, grief, sadness. And there's also vulnerability in love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. And love is an example that she uses in the book. It's one of the most uncertain, incredibly risky, emotionally exposed places. It's super scary, but can you imagine your life without love or being loved? So to let ourselves sink into the joyful moments of our lives, even though we know they are fleeting, that's an intense form of vulnerability. And it may feel like the floor is falling out. So I made a short list of things that recently made me feel vulnerable. Asking for help, reaching out to my aunt who tried to kill herself, driving my friend to fertility surgery and hoping I do a good job, say and do the right things, and a mammogram appointment. And when I review the list now, none of those things feel weak to me, but at the time, they did. But with some distance and perspective, and if I'm truly honest with myself, I think that list feels brave. All those things, when I'm not in them, I'm not in that moment, and they've maybe even just passed, I think those were brave things that I did. So when we watch other people be vulnerable, when we have that perspective or that distance, we think it's courageous. We love seeing raw truth and openness in other people, but we are afraid to let them see it in us. So basically, you know, Brené says, I am drawn to your vulnerability and I am repelled by mine. And the challenge here to this myth and the opportunity is to value our own vulnerability as much as we value it in others. And to remember that vulnerability is not weakness, it's daring greatly. And that the willingness to show up changes us, it makes us a little braver each time. It's one of my favorites in the book. The second myth is, I don't do vulnerability. This myth feels a bit humorous to me because life itself is vulnerable, and the challenges of being alive, being in a relationship, and being connected are just a few examples. Experiencing vulnerability isn't a choice. The only choice we have is how we're going to respond when we bump into uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. And we'll get to some of those responses later in the class. The third myth is that vulnerability means letting it all hang out. And the truth is, vulnerability is not a sharing free-for-all. It requires boundaries and trust. And this means sharing our feelings and experiences with people who have earned the right to hear them. So it's a mutual process. It's a trust-building process. But it's also a chicken or egg issue. We need to feel trust to be vulnerable, and we need to be vulnerable in order to trust. Help me is this little bit here, that trust is built in very small moments. In any interaction, there is the possibility of connecting with your partner or turning away from your partner. And trust is a product of vulnerability that grows over time and requires work, attention, and full engagement. Again, not totally comfortable, you know? Myth number four, we can go it alone. In actuality, vulnerability is not something we can do alone. We need support. We need someone to pick us up when our ass gets kicked. This means asking for help. And Brené's research shows that vulnerability begets vulnerability and that courage is contagious. There's a snowball effect that when one person is willing to be vulnerable, that behavior is perceived as courageous and inspires others to do the same. So those are the four myths of vulnerability. I'm going to do them pretty quickly because there's a lot to this book. But I'd like to ask you guys, did any of these myths about vulnerability surprise you?
No, none of them surprised me, you know, and it's just like I've always, lived my whole life believing that, you know, it was a bad thing to be vulnerable, because then people are going to take advantage of you, or they're going to think you're weak, or, you know, whatever it is. So, yeah, I've just always thought, oh, you know, it was a bad thing. So that, you know, trying to turn that around, again, is another one of those situations where it's just like, oh, yeah, it's okay if I say I don't know how to do something.
Right. And even if that's uncomfortable to say, you know, it's sort of realizing how uncomfortable it is to hide that, you know, or to try to pretend that you do know something. So, you know, we get really good at a certain behavior. We adapt to tap dancing or pretending or acting like we know everything or pretending like everything's okay when it's not. And that actually comes at a cost. It's like, yeah, a hustle, right? There's a hustle to that, and it's never ending because once you start that, you have to keep it up forever. And so we get really good at that, I think, and that, in a way, almost becomes easier because we can do it. And then there's an opportunity to drop that hustle and drop that burden and deal with the vulnerability hangover, because in the end, that will be more freeing, and you don't have to keep up the hustle.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that hustle, you know, in the end, I think really then, you know, nobody knows who you really are. Maybe not even you, not even me.
Right, and then that comes down back to being hardwired for connection. And if nobody really knows you, and if you're not being who you really are, then that connection with other people doesn't even feel real or authentic. So it's like you might be connected, but they're all connected with this version of you who's doing the hustle. And maybe they're doing the hustle too, and that's why you guys connected. And then the real meaningful connection that we're all craving might escape us. So thank you, Candy, for sharing that. Does anybody else having thoughts to share about these myths? You know, I never thought of vulnerability before this book. I never even really, that word never really crossed my mind. But I certainly realized I had ideas about what it meant, that it meant that you were exposed and you shouldn't be exposed.
Wendy, this is Kim again. And I have to say that I love her book and I love her work, but I think it was the second one where she talks about people have to earn the right, mm-hmm. you know, to be trusted.
that was a big, big lesson for me because I tend to trust too easily and, you know, kind of that open life, open mouth kind of thing. And so that was a really powerful lesson for me, was to really understand that, yes, people do need to earn, you know, the right to have that information and to bring, you know, to be brought into the inner circle. So I really was impressed by that one. For me, you know, almost the opposite, but it was great for me, that one.
Yeah, I think that really is a good point because, you know, as coaches and even as clients, you know, we are encouraged to be transparent, authentic, and open. That doesn't mean you walk around without your clothes on, right? I mean, it means that you are, you honor yourself first and make sure that the transparency, authentic, and openness is going to people who are also bringing that to you. I guess that's kind of the way I think about it. But I have certainly experienced this where people are pushing for you to be, like, I've particularly noticed this with my husband when he goes into job interviews and they are pushing him to say things and he's just met them. And it's very awkward because you want to have a good connection with these people and they're pushing you to be vulnerable and yet you just met them. And so that forced connection feels really icky to most of us. And so I think it's trusting our gut about whether or not someone it's okay to share with someone, because it's not like it's a analytical decision like, okay, they've been decent to me for 9 months, so now I'm going to share something. It's almost like you have to go with your intuition about whether or not someone is going to be empathetic and be the kind of partner, whether it's a friend or, you know, whatever kind of relationship it is, whether or not it's safe. Because I can't trust my brain on that one. I have to just go with my gut, I think. How did you do that, Kim? How did you figure out when it was okay?
I think I got burned a few times. And you know, and learn to do just exactly what you said, to trust, you know, to listen more to my intuition versus just that sort of hustle for acceptance or, you know, hustle to be part of the popular group or whatever it was. Or, you know, I think too, sometimes for me it was almost an overexertion to get people to like me. You know, like if I tell you intimate things about me, then, you know, you're going to be my friend or something. I'm not really sure. I haven't totally analyzed it all. I've just learned the hard way. So,
well, I think that's true, that we think if we share something, then we'll have a connection with this person.
Yeah.
You know, if we're vulnerable, then we'll now have a connection, and that will solidify our relationship, and we will have the connection that we crave. And I do think that works for a lot of cases, so I could see why that would be tempting for all of us. So, thank you again. A large portion of the book is devoted to understanding and combating shame. This is, again, something I haven't really thought a lot about, but the reason she talks about it in this book is because it's one of the biggest barriers to vulnerability. We all have it. We probably avoid talking about it. And the less we talk about it, the more control it has over our lives. So I couldn't even have told you what shame was before this book. I just know that hot feeling of shame when you might regret something and you wish you could take it back. There's some examples from the book. Shame is getting laid off and having to tell my partner. Shame is hiding the fact that I have an addiction. Shame is my DUI. Shame is my spouse asking for a divorce. And, you know, Brené's definition of shame is the fear of disconnection, that if anybody knew those things, if I stopped hustling, I would lose people. I would lose connection. And shame is an intensely painful feeling of believing that we are flawed and therefore not worthy of love and belonging. This is also one of the powerful things in the book for me. Shame waits for us to feel defeated. And when we are determined to never take risks, it laughs and says, I told you this was a mistake. I knew you weren't blank enough. Brené calls thoughts like these gremlins, messages of self-doubt and self-criticism that we carry around in our heads. Sometimes the greatest critic we have is ourselves. And shame says, I am bad. Not that I did something bad, but that I am bad. So, it, as I mentioned, it derives its power from being unspeakable, you know, hiding it from people. And the alternative is if we become aware of our shame and talk about it, that shame begins to shrink. And there's an opportunity to develop shame resilience. And Brené calls this gremlin ninja warrior training. So she has three ninja warrior moves. One is to practice courage and reach out. Share your shame and receive empathy. Empathy is the antidote to shame. And empathy is the sense that you are not alone. It's the me too, or I've been there, or I can relate. Connection, I guess. And it's the sense that someone is listening and holding space without judgment. The second ninja warrior move is self-compassion, to talk to yourself the way you would talk to someone you really love. You're okay. You're human. We all make mistakes. And the third ninja warrior move, is to own the story. It's like Michelle saying, I don't have the answer. You know, don't bury it. If you own the story of what happened, then you get to write the ending. So remember that shame thrives on secret keeping, and not discussing a traumatic event could be more. If you're interested in knowing more about shame, there's much more in the book. Brené shares research on how men and women experience shame differently, and I didn't have time to get into all that today, but it's really good stuff. The next part of the book is the last section, really, that I want to cover is the ways we avoid vulnerability. And Brené refers to these as our vulnerability shields. And these shields make us feel stronger, even though we get tired of dragging the extra weight around. So I'm going to talk about the three major vulnerability shields. Again, these are ways that we cope with the discomfort of being vulnerable. And they are foreboding joy, which I call squashing joy, because foreboding is not a word I would really use, perfectionism, and numbing. And that first shield, foreboding joy or squashing joy, this is when we're waiting for the other shoe to drop, when we believe that giving into joy will invite disaster, and when things are too good to be true and we don't want to tempt fate. If you've experienced this in your life, say aye.
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 By assuming disaster is around the corner or imagining the worst-case scenario, we expect disappointment, and this way we never see the joy. We sacrifice joy, but we also feel less pain, and we're afraid the joy won't last or there won't be enough of it. And Brené shares this story in her book. A man in his early 60s told me, I used to think the best way to go through life was to expect the worst. That way, if it happened, you were prepared, and if it didn't happen, you were pleasantly surprised. Then I was in a car accident, and my wife was killed. Needless to say, expecting the worst didn't prepare me at all. And worse, I still grieve for all of those wonderful moments we shared and that I didn't fully enjoy. My commitment to her is to fully enjoy every moment now. I just wish she was here now that I know how to do that. End quote. Joy is one of the most difficult emotions to feel because it makes us feel so very vulnerable. And sinking into joyful moments requires an incredible amount of vulnerability. The antidote to squashing joy is gratitude. So the daring greatly strategy for squashing joy is to be grateful for what you have, to celebrate it. Don't apologize for what you have. Every time we allow ourselves to lean into joy, we build resilience and cultivate hope. I'm going to say that again. Every time we allow ourselves to lean into joy, we build resilience and cultivate hope. So there's a couple of things that have worked for me. One is I try to catch myself when I'm doing that. Like before this call, I took out the staple in my notes. Like I had all my notes stapled together, and I thought, oh, my God, what if they what if my notes get out of order? Like, I was foreboding joy. I was expecting disaster, as small as, like, somehow some sort of wind would come into the room and stir up all my papers and they'd be out of order, or that the electricity would go out. I mean, I can do that so easily. I can imagine bad things happening really, really easily. So I try to catch myself in those moments, and I talk to myself and I say, sink into this moment. And it's like, feel for the joy. And that helps ground me. Brené also suggests saying to yourself, I'm feeling vulnerable and I'm grateful for blank. Fill in the blank. When we regularly experience joy, we are stronger when the bad things do happen, because they will happen. It's almost like front-loading self-care and joy so that you can better handle the really tough times. The second shield is perfectionism, believing that if I do everything perfectly, I'll never feel shame, blame, or judgment. If you've experienced this, say I.
What?
What's perfectionism? I've never heard of it. It's a hustle. It's not self-improvement, even though we might like to think it is. It's about trying to earn approval. It's really about what other people think. And it's pretty self-destructive because perfection doesn't exist. It's an unattainable goal. And there is no way to control the perception of others as hard as we may try. It's exhausting because it's a never-ending performance. That sounds very familiar to me. The daring greatly strategy for perfectionism is to appreciate the beauty of cracks. By that, she means finding the beauty of our imperfections and practicing self-compassion. There's another quote in the book. Brené quotes Gretchen Rubin, who's the author of The Happiness Project, and she says, I remind myself, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I'm sure you guys have heard that one before. She said, a 20-minute walk that I do is better than the 4-mile run that I don't. The imperfect book that gets published is better than the perfect book that never leaves my computer. The dinner party of takeout Chinese food is better than the elegant dinner that I never host, end quote. And Brené also shares some thoughts from, and I don't know if it's Andrea Scherer. She's a life coach and photographer who shares her thoughts on giving permission to do things that are good enough. Her mantras are, quick and dirty wins the race, perfect is the enemy of done, and good enough is really effing good. I think are really nice mantras. The last shield is numbing, using whatever we can to dull our pain and discomfort. And one of the most universal ways we do this is to create a state of crazy busy. If you've experienced this, say I.
Aye.
we want to numb our anxiety, our disconnection, and our shame, and we will do almost anything to escape that combination. Makes us feel isolated and powerless. So Brené's comment was, for me, it wasn't just the dance halls, cold beer, and Marlboro Lights of my youth that got out of hand. It was banana bread, chips and queso, email, work, staying busy, incessant worrying, planning, perfectionism, and anything else that could dull those agonizing and anxiety-fueled feelings of vulnerability. She adds, vulnerability led to anxiety, which led to shame, which led to disconnection, which led to Bud Light. End quote. So,
I want a martini and a cupcake just listening to you right now.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. And so does banana bread and chips and queso. So, of course, her point is that numbing our vulnerability also dulls our love, our joy, our belonging. We can't selectively numb our emotions. So the daring greatly strategies for numbing, learning to feel your feelings, which I can feel that icky feeling right now, and staying mindful about our numbing behaviors. So this might look like a shift from how can I make these feelings go away to what are these feelings and where did they come from? So it's not what you do, the eating or drinking or watching TV, et cetera. It's why you do it that makes the difference. So there's an opportunity to think about the intention behind our choices. Are these choices comforting and nourishing me, or are they temporary reprieves from difficult emotions like vulnerability? So Brené says, sitting down to watch one of my favorite TV shows is pleasure. Flipping through channels for an hour is numbing. So that's a distinction that I can easily understand. And like most anything else, it starts with awareness, right? Paying attention to our feelings and our behaviors. So I've quickly described the most popular vulnerability shields, squashing or foreboding joy, perfectionism, and numbing. And Brené talks about six more shields in the book. So if you want to know more, there is definitely more. And, you know, the rest of the book is devoted to vulnerability as it relates to values, education, our work and parenting. So there's a lot more for you if you want it in the book. But for this class, I tried to pull out the things that I found the most helpful in my life and in my work with clients. So, you know, we're 43 minutes into the hour, so I'm just going to wrap those up real quick and then do a couple of last-minute things. But a quick review of those things. We are hardwired for connection, love, and belonging. Many of us fear that we're not worthy of this connection, that we're not worthy of love and belonging. And as a result, we've created a culture of scarcity and not enough. A solution for the scarcity culture is to create a life that is defined by courage, compassion, and connection. Vulnerability is the catalyst for these things, for courage, compassion, and connection. And to better understand vulnerability, we reviewed the four major vulnerability myths. We talked about shame, which is the fear of disconnection, and ways to combat shame, including Gremlin Ninja Warrior training. Lastly, three major ways we avoid vulnerability with our shields and the daring greatly strategies for dealing with those behaviors. It's a lot of content, and I tried to move through it very quickly. And I'd like to open up the call to all of you. Was there one thing in the daring greatly lessons that stood out for you? Maybe something you've read before but you've forgotten about, or maybe something you just heard for the first time. Jump in.
Hi, it's Michelle. I loved hearing, I read the book, and I'm familiar with Brené, and it was so cool to hear you just kind of touch on the thing about vulnerability being weakness, because even though I still resist it because it's just so hardwired into me. But then it made me think of what you said, which I also loved, which is something, you know, I love data points, Wendy, but, the, 144, whatever.
Impressions, you know, yeah.
Impressions to reverse. And I was just arguing with a spiritual guide the other day with, you know, who I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Who said, is it true? Because it's not hard, because it's just a habit. And I said, well, sometimes shit is just hard, and that's what makes it worth it. So, yes, it is hard. I don't. Yeah. So here I am arguing with him about the work. Anyway, but it made me feel better when you said that, because I felt like so sure in my gut. Like, I know you have to change how you think about things, but I love that sort of compassion that it does take time to retrain your brain to, like, have these ideas really sink in. So thank you. I appreciate hearing it again. I obviously need it. I was like, damn it, I forgot about that.
Well, it's really that self-compassion piece, right? It's like,
yeah, exactly.
You might know all these things intellectually, and you maybe want to, like, move on them, but the way to do it is through kindness. And, you know, that's not something we necessarily do well. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're the suck it up, you know. I don't want to hear about it. Figure it out. So, mm-hmm. To really slow down and say, you know, what would be kind, or what would I say to my best friend? You know, as basic as that sounds, I mean, if I really treated myself the way I treat my best friend, I would be so much more kind. So much more kind. And I would be reassuring and supportive, and, you know, you'll get it next time. Anything would be better than what I instinctively, habitually say to myself when something goes wrong. So I've been saying that all the time to my clients. What would you say to me if I just told you that story? And the amount of compassion that they have for other people is huge. And yet we're starving to, you know, ourselves to give it to ourselves. So thank you for saying that, Michelle. I really appreciate it. Who else would like to add something? Anything that resonated with you or anything you'll take away from this material?
This is Candy. I think, just kind of going along with what Michelle said, I think the vulnerability equals weaknessness is, you know, I just really never even knew that it was that, you know, it was something that was, I was investing so much energy and so much effort into, you know, like you said, keeping up the hustle kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And now what I realize is that, you know, it's a part of me. And so as I work towards, you know, softening that, and I've noticed that the people around me who have known me for, you know, my whole life or whatever are just like, well, what do you mean? You know, you're the strong one. You're the one who's going to figure this out. You're the one who, you know, is going to make everything okay. And so it's almost like, you know, I know Martha Beck talks about, you know, the elevator, and as you, you know, as you move down your best path, you know, your elevator empties out. And I kind of feel like this is kind of the same thing, where it's just like, well, if you're not going to make the decisions anymore, then, you know, why are we still in relationship or whatever it is? Either that or just getting downright, you know, pissy about the fact that I, you know, won't do it. And you know, and it's new to me, so it comes across kind of weird. I know I don't, like, you know, say it in a way. And so what happens is, you know, like I just had a conversation with my mother too long ago, and I just said, I'm not going to be the planner anymore. I'm not going to be the fixer. I'm not, you know, if you want to get the family together, then you figure it out. And it was just kind of like, well, you know, I didn't, you know, at first I felt guilty because it's like, oh gosh, you know, I didn't say that the way, you know, I really hurt her feelings and that kind of thing. But then once it was said, whether it was awkward or weird or whatever, I just felt like this incredible weight lifted off of me. It's because, oh my God, I just freed myself from, you know, having to be the one all the time. Just, it's very interesting how other people, you know, are kind of responding and trying to kind of like, you know, suck me back into the shallows, if you will.
Yeah,
and yeah, it's just like, come back. We like you the way you were. And you know, it's hard because, you know, I do feel like that elevator's emptying. And, you know, and some of the people are people who, you know, have been a big part of my life, so.
And that's a very vulnerable place to be, Candy, you know, just to go through change like that. And even though you experienced some freedom and you said, I'm not going to be the planner anymore, when you told the truth and you felt this freedom, when you're not shackled like that, then you can decide even if you, you know, you might feel free to do something that you just said you wouldn't do, you know. Because
right.
You tend to go from one extreme to the other, like all the planning, I'm doing none of the planning. And then, you know, when you sort of, you're balancing through extremes and you might find your middle, you know, where maybe it's not all or nothing, or it's not black and white, but it's almost like you have to experience that full freedom to be able to then choose your level of engagement, your level of involvement, you know, where you're going to invest or not. And so I know you are daring greatly on many levels in your life right now. So you are, you know, you're not alone in that elevator at all. I will ride the elevator with you. You're kind of stuck with me. So I'm going where you're going.
Excellent. Okay.
Oh, go ahead. That's all right. Please.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if anybody else would like to share anything about the class that will stick with you or will be helpful for you, or anything that, you know, it's confusing even. Be happy to address that. And if not, that is so okay. So there's just two things I want to do before the class ends. Second to last thing here is I want to share one of my favorite sentences from the book, and this is Brené talking. She says, "I can honestly say that nothing is as uncomfortable, dangerous, and hurtful as believing that I'm standing on the outside of my life, looking in, and wondering what it would have been like if I had had the courage to show up and let myself be seen," end quote. The reason I like that so much is that it reminds me that although being courageous is pretty damn uncomfortable, not being courageous is far worse. You know, Candy, it makes me think of the hustle that you were doing for so long, and, you know, were you even aware of how unhappy you were? Were you, you know, the hustle can be very seductive.
Mm-hmm.
So, lastly, to help reinforce your bravery, I'd like to read a portion of the Daring Greatly Leadership Manifesto. And when I send out the class recording to you all, I'll also include a link to the manifesto. I think it would be a great way to close our call tonight. Before I do that, is there anything else anybody is dying to say, or any questions that are burning about anything we talked about tonight? Just want to give you the opportunity.
I'd just like to say thank you very much for the refresher.
Thank you, Candy. It was a good refresher for me too, actually.
Yeah.
Anything else before I just read a little bit of the manifesto? And then you'll all be free to go. Live your lives.
Wendy, this is Susan. I just had a quick comment.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Sophia. I wanted to... Huh?
Oh, I called you Sophia.
The Italian Susan.
Hi, Italian. The Italian Susan, Sophia.
I was just thinking over from just some notes I took during the call how it's so brilliant that Brené Brown came up with this term daring greatly. It's so empowering to look at vulnerability as daring greatly. I was just thinking of the feeling that I get from that as opposed to uncertainty, risk, emotional weakness, what we normally would consider vulnerability to be. It's a really, really great concept, and again, really good to hear you reinforcing it in the call. So thank you, and thanks for doing the call.
I think that's a great point, is that we're kind of flipping vulnerability on its head, and instead of thinking of it as weakness, we're going to decide to think of it as daring greatly. Like, that's up to us, right? Like, yes. That's a beautiful point, is that I can keep emphasizing how it's uncertainty and risk and emotional exposure, or I can reinforce with 144 impressions that being vulnerable is daring greatly. And if we all agree to that as a collective and we all are going to honor that and value that and encourage that in each other, I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? I mean, really, like, it's just we can define vulnerability, you know, differently and have it not be something that makes us feel weak but actually makes us feel brave, because there's just no shortcut to courage. Like, if I told you the only way to get to courage was to go through vulnerability, there's just no other way. You're going to have to face uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. It's like, oh, fuck. Okay, I guess, if that's the only way. But, you know, it's also the language of it is to say, you know, if you are vulnerable, you are daring greatly. Like, that is the path.
Yeah.
And we can focus on what the strong impressions, because they're both true, right? There's risk and and uncertainty, but there's also strength. And so thank you, Susan. That's such a great point.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so you guys, I'm just going to read a couple of sentences from this manifesto. Know that it'll come in your mailbox in a couple of days if you'd like to have it. And then we'll say goodbye. So, Daring Greatly Leadership Manifesto. We want to show up. We want to learn, and we want to inspire. We are hardwired for connection, curiosity, and engagement. We crave purpose, and we have a deep desire to create and contribute. We want to take risks, embrace our vulnerabilities, and be courageous. Above all else, we ask that you show up, let yourself be seen, and be courageous. Dare greatly with us. And I would like to thank all of you here for showing up and for daring greatly. And have a good night.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you so much, Wendy.
Thank you, Fear Fighters. Thank you for joining my call, and have a good night. Bye.
Bye, Wendy.
Bye.